First of all, I should welcome you here to this afternoon, late afternoon, early evening session on global health. My name's Ken Fleming. I'm head of the medical sciences in Oxford. And as I say, it's my pleasure to welcome you here. It's such a fantastic day in many ways, primarily because the weather's terrific for a change. But I hope you've enjoyed the other functions that you've gone to today. And this is one of the last ones we've got. Just a couple of observations. I know you'll all be well aware or pretty familiar with global health, the burden of disease which is related to problems around the world, particularly in developing countries. What you probably are not aware of is, in fact, your university, the University of Oxford, has arguably one of the strongest global health programs in the world. It's actually a largely unrecognized treasure, and I'm hoping we're going to hear quite a bit about that today, and Oxford's place in the global health arena. We're very lucky to, in fact, have the presentation by John Bell, Professor John Bell, who's the Regius Professor of Medicine. John was made Regius in 2003, so a few years ago. In fact, John's Canadian, despite his slightly Scottish name, and he came over to this country as a Rhodes Scholar in the 70s, trained in Oxford, went to London and California, before coming back to the UK in Oxford in the late 80s, became Nuffield Professor of Medicine in the 90s, and then Regius Professor, as I said, about 4 or 5 years ago. He's now, amongst his many distinctions, President of the Academy of Medical Sciences and also Director of a thing called the Office of Strategic Coordination of Health Research. This is arguably, in my view, one of the most powerful positions in biomedicine in the UK. And it's a testament to his large standing in the biomedical community. Having said all of that, one of his great interests is global health, and he's going to tell us about that and Oxford's role. John.
Thanks very, very much, Ken. I always tell this story when people rev up this story about the Regius Professorship, because it's a slightly curious job that nobody really knows what it is when you get appointed, including the appointee. You get strange letters from the Queen and the Prime Minister. But when I was appointed, I had a funny phone call from Stan Peart, who's an old friend who's professor of medicine at St. Mary's, and he said, "Oh, John, fantastic. You've been appointed Regius Professor." He said, "But I don't know whether you know, but in Oxford, the Regius Professor of Medicine is to the faculty what the lamppost is to the dog." So, however size my head was, it did get smaller at that point. I've been asked to walk you through some of the aspects of our global health sciences program. And it is really, I think, one of the most remarkable stories in the medical sciences division. And it's remarkable because we started doing global health before global health was global health. In fact, when we started doing it, we called it tropical medicine. And it began in the mid-70s when David Weatherall, who was Nuffield Professor of Medicine at the time, and David Worrell, who was a clinical scientist in his department with a particular interest in snake bite, and who was having some difficulty in Oxford actually raising clinical studies, decided that they would approach the Wellcome Trust to see whether the Wellcome would be interested in funding a unit based in the developing world. And Peter Williams, who was head of the Wellcome Trust at the time, recognized that Sir Henry Wellcome, who set up the trust originally, was very keen on looking at the issues of the developing world from a health perspective, and so it fit with the trust's original deed. And they went together to Bangkok, and there are a variety of stories that come out of that trip, which I won't tell you about. But anyway, they came back, and they agreed, the Wellcome Trust agreed to fund its first unit in tropical medicine or global health in Bangkok, based in the University of Oxford. And it was really that, in the mid-70s, that unit was headed by David Worrell initially, and then by Nick White, who's been its director for the past 20 years. And it was that concept that if you're going to study the diseases that afflict the developing world, it's best to do it in the developing world, in a structure, in a unit, where you can get access to collaborations by local investigators, you can get access firsthand to the diseases that are afflicting those populations. And it was that model, which was very unique in the UK at the time, indeed very, very unique worldwide, which we've extended and developed really over the past 30 years. And the program has a number of considerable strengths that have emerged. One is a set of units, which you see on one side, that are all based really around that original model, but also a series of core expertise within the university in the basic sciences that actually support those units. So fundamental immunology research, fundamental parasitology research around pathogens like malaria, a strong vaccinology unit for developing vaccines, and there's a relationship between the units that are at the coalface, as it were, of studying these diseases and the activities, the core activities in Oxford, which feed those at a regular level. So that's a model which has evolved over 30 years and which has been, in my view, enormously successful. And as Ken has said, this is really one of the strongest programs, I think, in Oxford. It accounts for about 25% of our total research grant income, funds activities and studies related to these major global health issues. So it's proved to be very successful. Now, this is an Oxford slide, and you can talk to the Vice Chancellor about this if you want, but this is relevant no less to this story about global health, because when you're out there first and you're trying to work out how to get from A to B, you're paving the way. You're the pathfinder in many of these arrangements. And it's not without its difficulties to establish these units and to run them over a long period of time. We've survived now three coups in Thailand, which is a considerable achievement. We've survived a variety of other political issues in most of our other sites. And most recently, we've had a challenge in that the president of one of the countries in which we operate had decided that he himself had discovered the cure for HIV, and as a result, it wasn't really necessary for us to function there any longer. So it requires a certain amount of political nuance to try and work through these things and maintain the power of these units as they stand in the developing world. So there are a series of challenges associated with that. We've now got what are essentially five major units, and these units actually number in terms of hundreds of people in many cases in terms of what they do. And they all have shared funding and collaborations with local investigators. So our units are all embedded very much in the local infrastructure. The original unit in Bangkok has spun out a unit in Vietnam. There's a major unit in Khalifi, also funded by the Wellcome Trust. Sarah Rowland-Jones from here runs the MRC unit in the Gambia. And we have a large unit in Beijing, which is a joint unit with the Chinese CDC. And so those have actually functioned extremely effectively and have spun out a series of other smaller units in Nairobi, Durban, Sri Lanka, Laos, and the like. So there's a host of these units. And we have a standard set of rules by which we operate. One is the units always have people from Oxford, which are based there and live in the country in which we're operating. So we don't use them to fly in and out of and to collect samples in that way. We try and be embedded in the local research infrastructure. Secondly, it's always done collaboratively with a local institution. So we don't set up standalone things. We go there when we're asked to collaborate with local institutions, and we try and make that work over relatively long periods of time. And the third thing is we like all our units to function as part of a bigger network. So these units get together once a year for a big meeting. They interact on studies. They relate information back and forth and use the Oxford Hub to provide them with a set of basic science skills. So those are the rules under which we run the units. And they cover a whole range of different diseases that are relevant to the developing world. And this figure is extremely interesting because when you start to look at what kills people around the world, but particularly in the developing world, you can see that for the billion poorest people on this planet, all of whom live in the low-income countries, the biggest causes of death remain the infectious diseases. And that is our major focus in most of our units in Southeast Asia and in Africa, because that's the major set of causes of death. But you'll also look that as you move into the lower middle income countries, and these are the countries that have developed beyond those in sub-Saharan Africa, you find that the infectious diseases are actually becoming very much more under control. And the thing that is killing people in these environments are the major epidemic chronic diseases, the big vascular diseases, stroke, coronary artery disease, diabetes, and cancer. And those then start to dominate at epidemic levels in the lower middle income countries and are still the dominant play up through the high income countries. And so it really requires a sort of dual approach if you want to commit seriously to global health. One is to focus on these major infectious diseases, the ones like malaria, tuberculosis, diarrheal diseases, and HIV, and also to think about some of these chronic diseases as a second strand. And we have built programs in both. They're relatively separate programs for the reasons you can imagine, but I'd like to describe some of those to you now so you can get some feel about the sort of things that we do. And so let me first of all talk about the infectious disease program. And you can see this rather optimistic statement that was made in 1963. And you can understand why. In 1963, things looked pretty good for the control of infectious diseases. They were running off the back of successful vaccination programs for most of the major common infectious diseases. And we were seeing the beginnings of modern microbial therapy for bacterial diseases. But you can also, I think, accept that this vision was, in fact, a long way off the mark, because the obstacles associated with developing interventions, either vaccines or therapy, for the big diseases, and they are malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, they have still been very resistant to interventions. And the big problems associated with getting to the patient populations who have those diseases and applying therapy, even if you have it, still provides an enormous challenge in the developing world. So this hasn't worked out, and that's why we're still there working very hard at this particular problem. And in many cases, the biggest of these problems in many ways is carried by this little guy, which is the Anopheles mosquito. And you'll know that this disease, which is falciparum malaria, which this poor girl has in one of our units in Kilifi, is a lethal disease. Cerebral malaria caused by falciparum malaria still carries a mortality of 50%. The approach to therapy is not yet refined to any great extent, and there are a whole set of issues in the clinic that need to be evaluated and investigated. And our unit in Kenya, which was established in 1989, is actually in a perfect position to do this, because it sits on the coast of Kenya, just north of Mombasa, in an area which is holoendemic for malaria, which means that everybody gets bitten several times a year by malaria-infected mosquitoes. And so it's proved to be an area which, A, needed a serious healthcare provision, and we provide that particularly in pediatric terms, but also was ideal if one was attempting to study the epidemiology and the pathophysiology of this disease. Kevin Marsh took this unit on in 1989. He's been there ever since, and he's built an absolutely spectacular program in this disease, largely focused on children and small children who are very often those who suffer most from this disease, and very much integrated with the local healthcare system. This was the hospital which he took on in 1989. It's primitive but highly effective. He built a whole cadre of investigators who work alongside him in Kenya. And a major focus of his program has been capacity building locally, which has been enormously successful. And very recently, we opened this building there, which is the new research institute at that same hospital, which provides absolutely state-of-the-art scientific support for all these programs. And which has actually provided the sort of labs that you could find down the road in Oxford at that sort of quality, which has greatly helped our ability to train and develop local scientists as well as take on new projects. So the Kenyan facility has been a real powerhouse for us. But so, of course, is Thailand, which is where the original unit was set up. And this, again, was a collaboration between the Wellcome Trust and Mahidol University in this case. And that, under Nick White's leadership in the past 15 or 20 years, has spun out a whole series of other sites. Again, malaria is one of the major targets for clinical investigation. But you can see from this figure what a huge impact a single major site can have in Southeast Asia if you allow it to mature and develop over 30 years. So the main Bangkok unit is shown in Bangkok, but then a series of other dots relate to other major field sites where we have people in all of them. We have several in Laos. There's a very powerful site right on the Burmese border. There's a site in Kampuchea, and then sites extending, trial sites extending through Burma into Bangladesh. So this has actually had very substantial local influence in the investigation, particularly of malaria. And it's got a sister unit which sprung up and which was originally set up by Nick White and Jeremy Farah in Vietnam, which I'll talk about in a minute. Let me just tell you a little bit about some of the work they do there. They're very interested in severe and drug-resistant malaria. Their unit on the Burmese border in Shoklo is one where there is probably the highest rates of multi-drug-resistant malaria anywhere on the planet. It's an endemic region for malaria, and the refugees from Burma live in large refugee camps here. The guy on the right is Francois Nosten, who's our investigator there who leads this program and runs a very powerful clinical trials program to evaluate a whole set of new interventions in this disease. And one of the very powerful things that came out of this, and this is his laboratory, which is screening for malaria on the Thai-Burmese border, but one of the most powerful things that's come out of this has been the most fundamental change in the treatment of this disease, both severe disease and uncomplicated disease, which came from the evaluation and the demonstration that a Chinese herbal medicine called Qinghao Su or artemisinin turns out to be a dramatically effective antimalarial drug. And the studies which demonstrated that came from this unit in Asia and also from our units in Africa. And they demonstrated that this drug reduces the mortality of severe malaria by a full 35%. And these are really dramatic results. And this is a drug also for which resistance has not yet been described. So it turns out to be highly effective also for uncomplicated malaria. And so when you turn to the WHO guidelines for how you look after people with malaria, you'll find that the Oxford unit has contributed two of the most important observations. The management for uncomplicated malaria and the management for severe malaria both come from the products of our units and has been a major breakthrough in the clinical management of this disease. The Vietnamese unit, which is spun out of Bangkok, is also equally powerful, but in a different setting. And Vietnam turns out to be a remarkably good place to operate because it has a large agrarian population with a lot of people living in close proximity to animals and is in very close proximity to a very large population base in Southeast Asia and Asia. And, of course, this is where the major new infectious diseases are emerging. Most of them passed from the animal pool to the human pool and then spread amongst humans. And SARS is perhaps the best example of a disease of that kind in recent years. And, of course, we're all waiting for the next one to arrive. Jeremy's unit looks at a very large number of different infectious diseases listed on the left. They have done a lot of work on typhoid, dengue, and tetanus. There's a lot of tetanus in Vietnam because during the American boycott, no one got vaccinated for tetanus, and they tend to walk around barefoot in rice paddies stepping on bamboo poles. So there are literally wards of patients with tetanus being managed by this group. So our better understanding of the clinical management of these major infectious diseases is coming out really dramatically from this Vietnamese unit. But you'll also recognize these guys who are our favorites, and you'll also recognize the story of pandemic flu or avian flu, H5N1 flu, which got the newspapers at least very worked up about this problem. And, of course, Vietnam has been the focal point in Southeast Asia and has had almost as many deaths as Indonesia from this disease. And most of those people have been treated in our unit in Vietnam, which is set up in collaboration with the Cho Kwan Hospital there. And so our scientists have actually had an opportunity to do the clinical investigation of what it is that kills you when you have avian flu and what can you do to stop that progression of the disease when you get it. And Jeremy has been the senior author on a series of New England Journal papers which has described this. Now, one of the problems with this disease is that there are 14 billion of these little critters around the world, and most of them are living literally underfoot in places where people are living. And we also now know that, in fact, it's probably not just an aerosol transmission of this virus, but it turns out the receptor for avian flu is expressed in the gut mucosa, which means that probably some of this infection is a result of eating infected chickens. And so that creates all kinds of issues because these are actually a staple food in very large bits of the world. So the epidemiology of this is actually rather challenging. But the good news is that until a mutation occurs which allows this virus to spread readily between human, from human to human, it's very unlikely to actually have a profound impact in human populations, and pandemic flu will not happen. So we do have a bit of time to get ourselves organized. The problem is that there have probably been about 10 times more meetings on avian flu than there have been people die of avian flu. And when I go to meetings, invariably the entire meeting, no one in the entire meeting has ever seen a case of avian flu. So there, you know, there is this problem that it is a threat, but it's sitting as a rather small issue which might blow up into something much bigger. Now, you'll also remember this guy, which was the way avian flu first arrived in the UK. It arrived in a parrot that sent the country into pandemonium. But the real risks in Western Europe are actually probably quite small. The map on this slide gives you some impression of the poultry density around Europe, and that's the darker the red, the more chickens you have. And you can see that that dominates. There are a lot of chickens in France. We all know that if you've ever been to France. But much of it is in Eastern Europe. And the little dots are known episodes of avian flu that have occurred. And there's not much. The further west you go, there hasn't been much. So in terms of avian epidemics, we're probably at relatively low risk. We will be at high risk only if the pathogen mutates. This is a really, really nasty disease, and I'm not the right person to show you these slides because it's Jeremy, and these are Jeremy's slides. But for those who, such as he, who's seen and looked after patients with this, it kills you very rapidly. It carries a 50% mortality, and it is a very, very unpleasant disease with these sort of consolidations in the lung and a severe cytokine-type symptomatology. So these patients get really sick. There are a number of things that you can do for them, not least of which use a drug which inhibits the neuraminidase, which allows the virus to settle on cells. And that's a drug called Tamiflu. And for those of you who are hypochondriacal like I am, you'll probably have a whole shelf of those at home. We've got about 50 packages. The bad news is that it turns out that, in fact, in the Vietnamese situation, there have been now a number of incidences of Tamiflu resistance. So don't count on that drug saving you if there's actually a pandemic problem with avian flu. But that's all work that's come out of our group in Vietnam, and they've been enormously successful at the clinical interface. There's lots for them to chew on. There are all kinds of examples of emerging infectious diseases, often in little small foci, but they can blow up into rather more major events if it's allowed to happen. And this is just a summary of the sort of emerging infectious diseases that we've seen. Some of them are new, some of them have been there, and they're re-emerging, and some of them, in America, you do occasionally get deliberately emerging diseases, but that's not prevalent here. I can't not talk about HIV. Of course, it's turned into the great killer of the infectious diseases. And you can see the expansion of prevalence of HIV in Africa, which, of course, we all know about, and it was one of the great modern human tragedies. It would be impossible to run these programs and not take a serious interest in HIV, and we've tried to feed this into our existing units, particularly in Africa. Although they've been focused originally in malaria, it's been quite obvious in recent years that they've had to pay significant attention to HIV. And there have been a couple of very interesting observations that have come out of this, which I think are very helpful for those of us who are trying to think about how you make a better HIV vaccine. The first is this story, which emerged out of Frank Plummer's cohort in Nairobi, where he was tracking prostitutes in the slums of Nairobi. And he found consistently that there was about 5% of these sex workers who, despite repeated exposures to HIV, didn't appear to get infected, or if they did get infected, clearly controlled the virus, so it was not measurable. And that suggestion that some people could mount an immune response that actually protected them against disease is actually probably the only sign that we might actually eventually get a vaccine where we can deal with this disorder. And it turns out that there are particular populations of T cells that we have particular interest here in Oxford that are actually are found in high numbers in these people who are resistant to the HIV infection. And that turns out perhaps to be an important key to how we might develop a vaccine. If you go to West Africa, where our unit is based in the Gambia, there's a very different prevalence of this disease than there is in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. HIV-1, which is the common form of HIV, is actually relatively rare. There's a seroprevalence of about 2%, but for many years it was actually less than 1% in the Gambia. But there is actually also quite a high frequency of HIV-2, and in fact there are some countries in West Africa where this cousin, as it were, of the HIV virus is present in as many as 10%, or seroprevalent in as many as 10 or 20% of the population. And there's been a great deal of speculation about whether infection with one virus actually protects you against the other. And that's been the subject of Sarah Rowland-Jones' work in the Gambia and Andrew McMichael here in the Human Immunology Unit. And it's been quite interesting because people who have this cousin of HIV, HIV-2, they actually have a normal lifespan. They don't get any signs of immunodeficiency, even though it infects the same cell populations, and it appears to be a natural human model of HIV infection. And it also, if you measure the immune responses to HIV-2, the non-progressors really resemble, have the immune responses that you'd like to see from an HIV vaccine. So this is giving us a lot of signals, I think, about where one might want to go with an HIV vaccination program. And it's possible to follow these patients around a number of cohorts, and there are two big cohorts that are being tracked at the moment, one based in the Gambia and the other one based in Guinea-Bissau, just south of the Gambia, where they're being tracked extensively and trying to be studied from an immunological perspective. This is all associated with a whole variety of challenges. You can say, well, we're going to do a cohort and track 3,000 people, but it's actually incredibly complicated in this environment. And you have to develop a different set of rules by which you operate, and I think the scientists who work out here really have to be commended for this. I'll tell you the story about a Rhodes Scholar that we had working in the Gambia who had gone way up into the back. The Gambia runs all the way back to the east, and she was up there trying to do some of this epidemiology in a small village where it was an animistic sect in the eastern bit of the Gambia. And we pay very close attention to ethics, and we always get approval at ethics at all. We get national ethics approval in the country we're in. We get ethics approval here in the UK because we're very sensitive to the criticism that we might be just in there to try and get data which in an unethical fashion. So we cover all the bases. And it was felt pretty important that she spoke to the tribal chieftain about whether it would be okay to collect some blood from the people. So she trotted along with the tribal chieftain and said, this is what I want to do, collect some blood from them. And this particular sect was actually very much into ritual sacrifice. Not of humans, but ritual sacrifice. So anyway, the elders in the village got together and said, well, what are we going to? And she said, well, we think we can give you approval. This is sort of local ethics committee approval. But in order to do so, you better trot down and find yourself a pig and slaughter it in the market square, and then we'll all be happy about the ethical approval. So anyway, off she went, and before you knew it, she had ethical approval to do what she needed to do. So you have to jump through rather different hoops in this environment than you do in the West. But that's what they do. Now, those are our clinical units based around the world, struggling to try and deal with these infectious disease problems. But it's pretty clear that this problem is not going to be solved without vaccines. And vaccines have ultimately been the solution to most of our major infectious epidemics. And we are very lucky to have a hugely powerful vaccine program based scientifically here in Oxford, but using the field sites as a way to evaluate their vaccines. And in fact, we're probably the only academic institution or institution of any kind, even commercial institution in the world, that has active and successful programs around the three major diseases, tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV. And we have active clinical trials in place for all of those. And indeed, our TB vaccine is unique and well in the lead in terms of new vaccines for infectious disease of any on the planet. So this is a very powerful and exciting program. It's got a lot of infrastructure associated with it. And just to give you some sense, the malaria program, which is led by Adrian Hill, who's also the director of the Jenner Institute and was one of our most exciting young scientists, involves a lot of work in the UK, developing the new vectors, developing the new approaches to vaccines. They do proof of concept studies in the UK. In other words, does this sort of work? Can you see the right immune responses? Can you protect people? And then it moves at the phase two level to our units in the Gambia and Kenya. So you can see how this is all knitted together to try and make these programs work effectively. And you may squint to say, what's going on there? Those are Anopheles mosquitoes that have been laden with malaria, falciparum malaria. And what's happened is that there are a number of human volunteers which have been vaccinated in Oxford. These are Oxford students mostly, not as bright as you thought they were. And they've been vaccinated with some of these new vectors to mount immune responses which are specific for the malaria parasite. And what happens next is that they go in and on a Starbucks cup, they put their arm on that, and the mosquitoes then can bite them actively to the point that they get malaria. And then you track them carefully to see, very carefully, to see what happens, to see if they're protected or not. And this is what's called a proof of concept study. It's entirely ethical, I assure you. And it works incredibly well for detecting whether you've actually got a therapeutic vaccine, potentially therapeutic vaccine. And this is some of the data from Adrian's group, and you can see that if you don't give the people a vaccine, those are the number of infected cells that you get in the control population. And then if you're using these two new vaccines, you can see this very dramatic reduction in the number of parasites that are actually survive in these individuals. And this is very promising data, and this vaccine is likely to get into definitive phase two studies over the course of the next year. And it will be the second of its kind, the other one having been developed by GlaxoSmithKline, which is now in late-stage development in Africa. But this, we believe, is an important new development in terms of prevention of these important diseases. We also have a big and broad HIV vaccine program led by Andrew McMichael. He was the first to put a vaccine into clinical trials in Africa, developed against the HIV found in Africa. And this is a picture of our local MP, who was one of the first people to receive the HIV vaccine trial in Oxford. Now, just for the record, we don't do the HIV vaccine trials like we do the malaria trials. So we just test immune responses. But that's again, has been an enormously successful program. Let me talk very briefly about a couple of other programs which have emerged from the division in recent years. One is addressing the whole issue of maternal health in the developing world. And the state of maternal health in the developing world is nothing short of a scandal. If you look at the lifetime risk of maternal death in sub-Saharan Africa, it's 1 in 16. And if you look at that in industrialized countries like the UK, it's 1 in 4,000. And that is a huge gap that can be sorted out with some of the standard technology which is available in the Western world. And the availability of conventional tools to measure intrauterine growth, postnatal growth, and to manage women during the course of their pregnancy and delivery, those simple tools could make a huge impact on those numbers. Now, it is true that things like malaria do contribute to this in a significant way, but those issues are often manageable in this setting. Well, the department here has been very interested in this problem and has put together an interesting program to try and develop even the standard tools for measuring intrauterine growth and the standard metrics by which you can apply these in different bits of the world. So, for example, the growth charts that you use here in Oxford are not useful in the developing world for all the reasons you'd imagine, but they are. They do need to be redone both for intrauterine growth and for postnatal growth. And they've put together a great consortium, which involves WHO, GE Healthcare, who's going to contribute about $10 million worth of ultrasound equipment, and 10 collaborating hospitals worldwide This is very likely to be funded by the Gates Foundation and will support the standard that establishing a set of fetal and newborn growth standards, which could be immensely powerful in trying to limit the impact of this mortality in the maternal and perinatal period. Right, I told you I'd deal with infectious diseases. I've done that. I want to just briefly talk about the major causes of death in the rest of the developing world. So there are large bits of the developing world, India and China in particular, but other bits of the developing world where the big impact is coming from these diseases. And you can see that diabetes, cancer, and in particular cardiovascular disease accounts for the vast majority of global deaths and a very large number of deaths in these developing economies. In these developing economies, those particular causes of death arise because of a series of risk factors, which we all know about because your doctor tells them about them, but they're the same risk factors there as they are here. And to give you some sense about how epidemic this is, in countries like Sri Lanka or bits of India or Hong Kong, the incidence of diabetes has now reached 20% of the adult population. And with that, diabetes will come almost invariably vascular complications, which actually have a profound impact on the health of those countries. We've been studying this in a whole variety of ways, but the powerhouse for this has really come from the Clinical Trial Service Unit, which is the unit which was directed for many years by Sir Richard Doll and is now directed by Sir Richard Peter and Rory Collins. They have a huge program evaluating the epidemiological basis of these diseases, particularly in China. There's a program which is based there, which is run by Zhen Zhaoming, and which involves a set of 10 sites in China where epidemiological information, blood samples, and other samples are taken from large numbers of patients involved in prospective cohort studies in a whole range of different environments. And as you all know who've been there, China is a great diversity of different environments, rural and urban, north and south. Now, this program is a sort of a mimic of, in fact, it was the precursor to the UK Biobank program, which some of you will know about because it's been in the news recently. But you can see their recruitment has been absolutely dramatic. And since July 2004, they brought in almost 500,000 individuals into this cohort. They have biological material and most of them that can be used for genetics and other such studies. And that's going to reveal a great deal, I think, about the underlying causes and risk factors associated with these major epidemic diseases. And these are the sort of numbers of people that they expect to see in that cohort as they follow them up over time. Now, that really leads to the question of what do you do about this? Because you've got developing countries that don't really have the resources for large amounts of the medical interventions that we have in the West. And so the real question is, how does one deal with this? And that really means that you have to address the risk factors with public health measures. And there are a complex set of risk factors, but a lot of them are the ones we know. And that is that these countries are increasingly smoking, they're increasingly developing a Western diet, and they're increasingly developing a sedentary lifestyle. And those are the three risk factors that drive the four major chronic diseases, diabetes, vascular disease, cancer, and obstructive airways disease. And that accounts for half of the premature deaths around the world. So if you can fix that problem, you have a huge impact on global health. We've set up an NGO to do some of this, to actually get the message out and to start to develop some of the research tools to evaluate the best way to do that. It's called the Oxford Health Alliance. And of course, the first and most important risk factor was one which was discovered by Sir Richard Doll, who is the Regius Professor here, in the 60s and 70s, and he was, of course, responsible for the discovery of the huge impact that smoking has on mortality of all kinds, vascular and cancer-related mortality. And that's had a huge impact in public health terms in the way we operate in the UK. The abolition of smoking in public places has been a major step forward. But even before that, there's been a huge impact. These are the statistics in general terms. 1.3 billion people smoke. There are 5 million people dying prematurely, largely because of tobacco use at the moment. This figure will rise to 10 million on an annual basis by 2020. So this is a very major risk factor and one that we've had a major contribution in analyzing. But we've also, I think, had a major contribution in this, which is a really a dramatic tale. because this is the change in lung cancer mortality, which is the major adverse outcome of people who smoke in the UK since the discovery of Richard Doll's observation that smoking was linked to this outcome. And you can see the absolute dramatic decline, particularly in males who had such an elevated rate of lung cancer over the past 50 years. And in fact, it's got to be one of the great public health success stories that's been delivered here in the UK. And the very nice thing about this study, and Richard Pito has actually generated this data, and these are his slides, is that there's a fantastic control population who didn't believe the Doll data, largely because it came from an English university, and that was France. And this is what's happened in France to mortality from lung cancer. And you can see that without a systematic approach to public health, the control sample shows really quite a dramatic. In fact, as Richard said, you can just take the other, if you do it on an overhead, you can just turn it over, and in fact, you get exactly the right result. And you can also see this burst in female lung cancer, which is the result of females smoking much more heavily in the 60s and the 70s. So this is the way it should be in terms, this isn't the way it should be. The control in the UK is the way it should be if one is going to manage these epidemics. We have other risk factors, and you're well aware of them. This is an example of the diet problem. You will, if you ever walk into convenience stores in North America, see this particular sort of phenomena. These are samples of Coca-Cola that you can buy, or colas of one sort or another. They used to be 16 ounce. They're now 64 ounce. If you drink a 64 ounce glass of Coca-Cola, that's 200 grams of sugar. And so you can imagine what that's going to do to you metabolically. And we're now getting some pretty good insights as to how this is actually operating in type 2 diabetes, subject that I'm particularly interested in. But there's a clear approach to managing this risk factor, and that is don't drink 64 ounces of Coca-Cola. And of course, the third factor in this is the sedentary lifestyle. And this is a great picture from Asia, because they're very much into this. But, they don't quite... They haven't quite got, like us, they haven't quite got the hang of this yet. And so, there's an awful lot to this. How do you keep people away from their computer screens, moving around, going to fitness clubs, if you like, and taking the stairs rather than the escalator? So, management, this is simple. It's not complicated. Nobody's going to win a Nobel Prize for this. But let me tell you, it's going to have a huge impact if it can be introduced in systematic and sensible ways. And it's going to have a huge economic impact. Interestingly, there's been very little done on the economic impact of these chronic diseases in the developing world. We published recently, 6 months ago, a monograph done with us and people from the World Bank, which highlights that this has a huge economic impact, both at a macroeconomic level, but also at the level of families. Because if you take one person out of a family because they've got diabetes or they've just had a heart attack, in countries like Sri Lanka or India, if you take the breadwinner out of a family, the whole thing collapses. The other partner has to go out and work. The kids don't go to school anymore. And all this development aid that goes in to try and build this up falls flat on its face. So I think there's terribly important messages here about how important managing this epidemic is. A series of programs, again, run out of the Oxford program. Community Interventions for Health is one where there are multiple sites around the world trying to develop interventions at a community level that control these risk factors and, as a result, control their outcomes. And this program, which was set up with Derek Yak at Yale and Oxford, just received $5.5 million from the Pepsi-Cola Foundation to try and see whether they can contribute to this process. Pepsi-Cola spotted the fact that they're not making any money out of Pepsi anymore, and they're trying to do the healthy food thing. So there's a whole series of things that have to be done there. So rather than go any longer, I just thought it's interesting to look at these predictions about what everybody's going to die from in 2020, because this is really the global burden of disease. And I think the engagement of the medical school here in these global problems is an enormously important statement, because I think this medical school, above all that I know, is truly engaged in the causes of premature death on a worldwide basis, not on a parochial, what kills you in Oxford, or indeed what kills you in the Western world, but what are the big issues and how can we help address them? And have committed people to actually work at the site where these diseases have their biggest impact. And I hope, this may be an optimistic view because we've heard this before, but if infectious disease mortality does fall by any degree, I hope we'll have some significant made some significant contribution to that over the next 15 years. But at the same time, I hope we'll also have had some role in trying to control the chronic disease epidemic. Thanks very much.